And welcome. You are listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM. This is our weekly program covering the arts and arts events in Valparaiso and throughout Northwest Indiana. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City. And we are your hosts for Art on the Air. Our 2019 underwriters for Art on the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum and, of course, our landlord here in this beautiful historic building here, Walt Breitinger. If you'd like to find out more about maybe getting space with many, many artists here. It's a real artist community. Call him at 219-462-5821. That's 219-462-5821. And we thank you for your generous support. Thanks to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager. And, well, Hester's now engineering the show with his guidance.
Oh, with tons of Greg guidance.
Yes, well, that's good, and we're doing a great job there, Esther. Hey, if you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts-related event or up here on our thing, please email us at our wonderful email, and we're not getting a whole lot of them, but we've got to get more people.
I know. If you have friends that you know are having an art exhibit, they're not sending their information in, so please do it for them.
And so that email is artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. That's artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. And like Esther was saying, we're expanding the scope of the show a little bit, not just visual arts, but we're talking about other things. So if you have things that are coming up, events,
book signings,
gallery openings,
right,
yes,
musical performances,
whatever it is, please make us know. By the way, we'd like to take a shout out for the minute for our listeners. You know, this is a community radio station and supported by you, the community, and some of our wonderful underwriters. And we'd like to encourage you to do so. We have a whole bunch of options for you, from just a family supporters, people. All the people here are volunteers. I mean, they volunteer their time to be on the air to bring you this great programming. So if you want to find out about how to support our station, go to wvlp.org/support. There's underwriter levels. There's levels of any amount. We appreciate any support you have. And every week I say this, but I'll say it again. Don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. So we're going to go on with the calendar, and I'm going to start with Porter County. And, now the arts calendar is starting to gear up a little bit more than it has the past couple of weeks.
A tiny little bit, yes.
Not a lot yet. But Valparaiso University Center for the Arts, Brower Museum, and they opened on January 8th, and it goes through the end of March. They have three exhibits, Icons on Ammo Boxes, and it's actually art that's done on old ammo boxes, and it's an interesting concept. The other one is a Sarah Krepp and Olivia Petrides. They're doing line, force, and burn rubber. And finally, they have the art of Lynn Olson, and they have already had their opening reception, so we missed that. But if you can get by there, they'll be going through March 31st. The Ellen Firm Gallery in US 12 in Beverly Shores is feeling Holly Jackson, which also is a part of the show today because she does the back cover of our guest book.
Yes, she does.
And it's her exhibit's running through the end of January, selection of her 2018 paintings. The Village Gallery at Pines, now this is one that did send us an email.
Thank you.
Michael Klaus Schmidt exhibit is going to open January 27th and run through February 28th, and they will have an artist reception on January 27th. The Village Gallery is in Pines Village Circle in Valparaiso. Chesterton Arts Center, you can still catch the Duneland Plein Air exhibit through January 30th. It's only there for a short time before they move on to something else. And, of course, they always have kids' classes, birthday parties, and a whole wide variety of things.
I saw the exhibit. It's really gorgeous.
Yes. I've been there several times for meetings and things, but, yeah, it's a great exhibit. So if you have a chance, catch it. It goes out January 30th. Finally, Art Barn in Porter County, the art of plantifying your life. It's 5 weeks of learning how to do that with life instructor Allison Misha. It starts January 30th, and you can recover from the holidays learning how to prepare delicious, fresh foods. So that's kind of what we have going on in Porter County. Let's move on to LaPorte County, see what we got going on there.
I don't think it's as healthy as what you just read. But okay, in LaPorte County, we have First Friday on February 1st coming up, and the Lubesnik Center for the Arts will be opening a new exhibit on that day. And that's in the Heinemann Gallery. And there's New Perspectives in the NIPSCO Art Education Studio. It's the 11th year of creative achievements of artists from the Social and Learning Institute and Paladin Incorporated. This program is generously funded by the Duneland Health Council, Burnt Offerings, Area Artist Association Gallery, Tom Brands from the Town of Pines. Paintings are created with oil on wood panels in his very unique art form, and this is his exhibition Since His Fire, where he took some of those paintings and reworked them. So it's very interesting. Southern Shore Art Gallery, our art association, will be opening again in February with the exhibit A Moment in Time, and that opens for that first Friday, February 1st, from 5 to 8 p.m. The gallery is located at 724 Franklin Street, and it's open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 12 to 5. You can find them on the web, Southern Shore Art Association, or visit the Southern Shore Art Association Facebook page. SFC Gallery will have the work of Holly Jackson during February. Holly's everywhere. Even in Chesterton, she's done her art is on the rubbish cans throughout the town. It's very beautiful. Yay, Holly.
Yay, go Holly.
Bling Contemporary Art at 1709 Franklin Street is exhibiting the work of Rick Lang and Suzanne Cohen Lang. Nest at 803 Franklin Street, the newly named Singing Sands Toastmasters Group meets every first and third Monday. The next meetings are February 4th and 18th. It's a very vibrant group. Saturday, January 26th, we have the debut of the Every Kind of Talent Show, emceed by the super fabulous Captain Ambivalent, who had a great time here with us, Larry.
Yes.
It's kind of open mic meets vaudeville meets show and tell, and we're still looking for our performers to join us. We're looking for magicians and dancers and filmmakers and actors and comedians and poets and storytellers. And if you have a TEDish talk, try it out. Visual artists, crafters,
well-behaved
authors. Yes, it's kind of, we're looking for all kinds of talent. And so that's at 7 p.m. And then we also get to hear Captain Ambivalent, so it's going to be a great evening. February 3rd, we have social media tips and tricks for artists starting at 2 p.m. Have questions about how to use social media for your art business? Join us for this discussion moderated by Jade McAloon from Pieces of Jade. February 9th, we have a scent event with Doreen Stelton of the Verdon Fairy. She creates perfumes using French perfumery techniques using organic essential oils, and we'll be talking about roses. Every third Sunday is the Mindful Fiber Artists. They meet, and the next meeting is February 17th from 1 to 3 p.m. That is on Sundays. We have ongoing piano lessons with Melissa Krause, and more details can be found on Facebook, The Nest Michigan City. And that's all for Michigan City.
You know what? Everything just happened at The Nest is really what it is.
It's just because it's winter.
Yeah, everything's happened at The Nest. So if you want to go to Michigan City and find out what's happening, go to The Nest. And you can also meet Esther face-to-face and everything. Moving on to Lake County, we have South Shore Arts. They still have some winter session classes, though they did begin January 7th. They still have some that start, so you can check on their Facebook page or website. Through January 29th, it's closing up, but their Indie Windy Love Story exhibit, curated by Ish Muhammad. That feels large works that are generally from Chicago, done in new environments, aging urban areas, manufacturing things. You still catch that there. In the Atrium Gallery, they just have a newer exhibit that just went up January 11th, the James Wachowiak, through March 24th. And he will have an artist reception in March on March 3rd. He's a Chicago-born artist. He has paintings of different color and familiar forms, communication of our day, and explores the intersections between color, visual ribbon, and music. Cafe Fresco, Laura, is it Izard you said?
Yes.
Okay, I'll get that right one of these times. I know her, but you know, sometimes you never hear the last name. She's still doing Cats Space Aliens through the end of this month, and that's at the Cafe Fresco.
They're totally charming.
Toll Theater still has Laurie Shimmer Carpenter's oil paintings. That's in Hammond, in the downtown area, not too far from the Paul Henry Gallery. Studio 659, they have their annual juried show, Artistic License. It's a salon-style show with a reception on the 25th, January 25th, so you can come see it. The reception runs from 5 to 7 p.m., and I have a couple of pieces in that one, too. Michigan Beach Arts and Creative District, the Callen Firm exhibit has been extended to the end of this month, January, at the Marshall J. Gardner Center, and he has, again, 38 drawings, 28 sculptures on display there. You can find out what's going on at the MillerBeachArts.org or go to their Facebook page. And to remind everyone, so a little bit of self-promotion, Nostalgic Structures and Scenics exhibit at the 8585 Broadway, this former Chase Bank building in Merrillville. You'll see 15 of my pieces, and they'll be going on through February 15th. And so that's about all that's going on in Lake County. Again, if you have information you'd like us to put on the air, promotion and everything, that's artontheairwvlp@gmail.com. artontheair@gmail.com. And you can, we'll be happy to read it on the air. And, you know, we're getting a bigger audience. And remember, we stream live. So if you have trouble hearing us over the air, you can always go to WVLP.org, stream us live. And this show repeats itself on Mondays at 5 o'clock. So you can hear Esther and I again and our wonderful guest.
Our very wonderful guests.
And our wonderful guest is an author from the local region here. He's you may have seen him if you've ever gone to this wonderful new restaurant, Fish Camp in Michigan City. He's the host there, but it hides a history that's so much more rich and everything. We have Trent D. Pendley here. If you've not met himself, you should introduce him yourself there. But he's written fictionalized stories. He has a great depth of what's going on in the region and everything like that. And we're so like welcome you to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, you have we'll talk a little bit about your personal history first before we get into your novel and everything like that.
Once we get in the novel, we're going to be.
Oh my gosh, yes! And I only got through it through the first three pages in preparation for this, you know. So, but three chapters.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not three pages. I almost couldn't stop because it's so rich with history. But tell us a little bit about yourself, your region roots, and where you've been, what you've done, and everything like that.
Well, I'm fifth generation in the area, so if I talk to you long enough, there's probably a connection between you and me. My early childhood was in Hammond. My family built a country home in Crown Point in 68, and I stayed there through schools and then went on to Indiana University Bloomington. I was part of their overseas studies program in Jerusalem in 1977. After college, I moved on to Scottsdale, Arizona, where I lived for 13 years. And my grandparents were getting older, and they wintered in Florida. So I came back before they were gone because I wasn't seeing enough of them. And I left Scottsdale, which my friends thought was crazy, and moved to Chicago, where I lived in Lakeview. And then my mother, who owns American Dream Realty in Crown Point, wanted me out of Chicago after 9/11. And mothers do what they do best, which is meddle. And so she found a house in the dunes that she thought would get me out of the city. And I took a look at the house, and I said, well, it's not the dump you showed me a few years ago out here. And it turned out that night when I wrote to a cousin in Dayton that the house was her childhood home. So it was kind of a meant-to-be situation to buy that house. And I had been working in fine jewelry for now it's 36 years. And so I was with a firm in Valparaiso for 9.5 years. And that part of my life is kind of closed, although I'm still taking appointments at Albert's in Schererville.
So do you just do the design, or do you also do
the... No, I manage stores and sold. Oh. Designing is more challenging because most people, even though this is an art show, most people don't have an imagination. And so what we're visualizing and you're visualizing are often two different things. And the business perspective goes right out the window, and there's no profit in the end because you're redoing it so many times. So from a business perspective, it's easier to sell what you have in front of you. Mm-hmm. The custom work is becoming easier with the CADs and the three-dimensional drawings, so people that don't have an imagination can actually see what the end result's going to be. But some people can't visualize what a ring looks like without the main setting in it. If the diamond's missing, they can't visualize what the rest of it's going to look like. Mm-hmm. So it was easier to sell what was in inventory. But anyway, I did that for 35, 36 years. I'm still doing it by appointment. Holly Jackson suggested that Fish Camp needed a host, and it's become this perfect marriage of a job because people come in and say, you sold us our engagement ring. And because of my long-term longevity in the region with five generations, there's a connection with almost all the guests. And it's a fun job, and all I have to do is schmooze and flirt.
I know, the social part is so nice.
And I love it, and I sell the book there also.
I know that's where we met first face to face. I think it was the first time my wife and I were there, and you kept saying, "Well, I think I know you," and I think we became Facebook friends.
Yes.
And that was the connection initially. And I said that, and you were trying to place me somewhere else. I said, "Well, no, I don't like that," but yeah, that.
I think because I'm tied in with the restaurant, people, the Facebook will suggest people that have liked the restaurant, and then it comes into that queue.
Right.
So I'll see faces, and then when they come in the restaurant, it's like I know that face from somewhere. And my short-term memory is getting really bad. So if a lady scolded me the other day when I went into a store, she says, you don't recognize me. And I said, well, I see 600 people a day sometimes.
Sure.
Just say the lighting is different.
Yes,
here.
Yes, yes. So.
Well, that's got to be a great boon for Fish Camp, too, to have someone, you know, of your stature being the face of the restaurant as people come in.
Well, it's a great institution. You've got two chefs that founded the restaurant, Nicole Bissonnette and Gary Sanders, who have great reputations in the area. You have David, who's our bartender, who's very creative.
Great smile.
And we've had some great servers in there. I nominated George for a Rose Award last summer, and he won.
Oh, fantastic.
And he had done something really significant. A boat pulled in, and all 14 people didn't have their wallets. And they were hungry, and they were going to have to cruise all the way back to Portage to their cars. And he paid for their meal. It was a $400 meal. And then they wired the money to him electronically.
Wow.
And when I heard that, I thought that is
above
that,
and
he won,
wonderful.
And he won. So, but he was fabulous. So, we have great servers, and we've got David, and I get to just schmooze and welcome people, and I love it. So,
excellent. You also lived a short time in Merrillville. I heard before the show, Young America.
When our house in I grew up in South Hammond. I went to Woodrow Wilson, which is a school my grandmother had laid the cornerstone on in '48. My maternal grandparents had been active with the PTA during the Depression and hosted a soup kitchen, and brought my grandfather had a radio show with the Voice of Labor in Chicago.
Okay.
And he actually brought Gene Autry in for a show to do a fundraiser to build the new school or for the soup kitchen. And because he was so unknown, nobody came. But I went to that school until fifth grade, and then we had to rent a house in Merrillville for a year while the new house in Crown Point was being built.
Yeah, I remember my parents bought property out at the then Lake of the Four Seasons development only because we used it mostly for the campgrounds, but we used to drive by as Young America was even becoming a new subdivision developing in the mid-60s or things like that. So that was like the big happening place in Merrillville.
Yes.
How times have changed. So you've been involved in jewelry. You've lived in Scottsdale. Then did you operate a jewelry business in Scottsdale?
Yes.
Or
mm-hmm.
Did you own it? Or
no, I've always worked for another company. I worked for Goldar Creations, which was a company out of California. I worked for Grunewald and Adams, which was probably the most exclusive store that I've ever worked for. Some of the trappings from that store actually appear in Toys in the Closet, my novel. It was a 6,000 square foot store with huge Baccarat crystal chandeliers that came from castles, and it was in the Biltmore Fashion Park, which was adjacent to the Biltmore neighborhood. So you had Fortune 500 families that lived there seasonally for a few weeks a year. So the customers and the jewels in the store were fantastic.
Now, before Toys in the Closet, we get into that. What other writing have you done maybe leading up to that?
Well, right after high school, I had gotten involved with the Jewish Federation, and that was still in Glen Park at the time, and then moved to Highland,
right.
And then now is in Munster. And in 75, they had started up the Eliana News, which was a monthly tabloid, and I was given the assignment of writing a column called The Chosen People. So it was kind of like an arts column of people that had won some kind of awards, and I would go after them and interview them. And sometimes I didn't know what I was doing. They sent me after Irv Chaikin once, who was the founder of, or he was the president and owner of Armstrong Jewelers, and they sent me over to interview him, and I had no idea what I was doing. and I had taken a boombox tape recorder, pressed the record button, and thankfully he talked for 2 hours, and he was incredible. His life story was on 2 hours of tape, and years later I sent that tape to his grandson, and about his coming from Russia at age 13, and being in World War I, and his major general became Franklin Roosevelt's appointment secretary in the White House. So Irving used all those connections to get the filtration plant for Hammond, the Civic Center, trees. He was like he was like the concierge for the city of Hammond. And so that was an opportunity I got from that column. And so I did columns for the Alleyana News for years. When I came back from Scottsdale, the Greater Crown Point Chamber of Commerce was putting together a walking tour of South Court Street, which is 80 houses from the courthouse to the fairgrounds. And I wanted to write that script because Crown Point had sort of retold its story in its own way over and over again. And I thought there was a broader story to be told.
An understory, huh?
Which upset the old-timers when it was done, but they all jumped on board in the end because I portrayed that there were shades of Lily White, and that was enough to upset some of the old-timers. But in the process of doing that, of doing the research for 2 years from between 1996 and 1998, we uncovered folklore, or what I thought was folklore, of a novel that had scandalized Crown Point in 1930. And even the old timers had never seen that novel. And it was by Ann Putnam. It was called The House on the Hill. Okay. She was a native of Crown Point that moved away in World War I and then afterwards became like a Jackie O book editor for Dodd and Mead in New York. And she published books on plays, mostly patriotic plays. I just had an exhibit at the Crown Point Library on her. I think there were 20-some books, I think, she published on plays. But her only novel was The House on the Hill, and that captured her hometown, which she never refers to Crown Point in the story, but it's the first four words are the Ruffleshirt Hill Drama Club. And so I found that book in Houston, and we gave two book readings of it in the old courthouse to standing room only crowds.
I bet.
And so that was a lot of fun. I was doing PR for my mother's realty company at that time. And so that all came out of the writing the first walk. When I came back from Scottsdale, I was writing Toys in the Closet. It became a 7-year project. And when I finished it in 2002, I became president of the Indiana Jewish Historical Society, and we published my Jewish History of the Indiana Dunes Country, 1830 to 1950 at that point. So I had all these pokers going on in the fire, and my novel kind of got set by the wayside. And then my mother found the house in the dunes, and so the novel just kind of sat. And then 2015 evolved, and the Indiana Bicentennial was in front of us, and I had tried to make this story a Hoosier Pride story, and I thought, what great timing to put it out now for the Bicentennial. And so there became Toys in the Closet, and now I'm working on the sequel.
Fantastic.
So from young times, did you always love history? I mean, was that, or
yeah,
did
my,
you grow
my,
into
my
it?
Mother had family photographs and had enchanted us with the family photographs and had often exaggerated the importance of the photographs. And I didn't realize that those pillars that were in the photographic studios, I thought that was the houses that our ancestors lived in with these ornate pillars. And one of the family albums had a portrait of Queen Victoria, and she used to tell her girlfriends when she was a child that she was related to the queen. But
I can imagine with five generations, there are many photo albums
yes.
to go through.
Yeah, and the people possessed those, and it became my quest during the American Bicentennial. I was in a class with Ron Cohen, who's kind of the foremost historian on the Gary Public Schools, And during the American Bicentennial, we tend to be, well, every time we have a centennial or a milestone in American history, we tend to get reflective. And Ron wanted us to write our family histories. And much of mine had already been collected and composed, but I had to sort of rewrite it. And so I was collecting photographs, and my grandmother would take us on these tours to Ohio, where she was from. She moved to Valparaiso in 1914 from Lima. And one weekend every July, we would take her back to Lima. And all of her, most of her relatives were dead at that point, so it became sort of a family cemetery tour. And I called it the Ohio trip. And we would take her to these different cemeteries, and she would get all animated about these people that were interred there, and Civil War people, and people that were pioneers in the, on the Ohio frontier. And much of that became fodder for my novel, Toys in the Closet.
You're listening to author Trent Penley on Art on the Air, WVLP, and we are pleased to have him as a guest here. He's a master jeweler, host at one of the great eating places in Northwest Indiana. But we'd like to now explore Toys in the Closet. I only had the chance to read the first three chapters. I was enthralled. I have to get the rest and get in.
I know. I've had lots of late nights with it where I just like, oh, come on, just a few more pages.
But it's really, truly... If you're interested in the region and the dunes, especially the focus on it, it really is a, it actually reads like history. It reads like it's a, it's an actual history. You know, even though it's fiction,
you can tell, historical fiction.
Yeah, I know it's a, and it, very much so. You and it caused me to go to Google Maps, start looking at places. Now, where would this be? You know, so I know it caused me to kind of explore. So, you talked a little bit about the origins, but let's talk a little bit about the book itself and what.
Well, the genesis of writing the book was that I had collected all this family history, and we're becoming extinct. So, you know, there's nothing more boring than to listen to someone's family history. Because it tends to get super, you know, superlative, like mother being related to the queen and so forth. But if I could weave it into a fiction, I think it was something people might enjoy. And there were some family vignettes worth sharing, like my grandfather with Gene Autry, and mother's family in the dunes were the local merchants. And the house that they had built during the Civil War in 1863 is still standing out there. And when I was writing the story in 96, there had been movements to expand the National Lakeshore boundaries, and that house was teetering on the boundary line of the expansion. And my fear was if that house was usurped by the park and its history wasn't known, that they would pull it down or abandon it and it would become burned like so many of the other properties have had a sad demise. Mm-hmm. There was a Civil War era house next door to the 1863 Lurie House that was burned down as an exercise in fire prevention. And the Lurie House, they had been the village merchants. Their store was sort of the Starbucks of its era because the neighbors would come around and sit around the potbelly stove at night and discuss politics. The store was the post office. I think one of the upstairs rooms had been used as a school. There was a blacksmith shop, a wagon shop there. When Furnaceville became an art colony in the 1930s, you had a number of students from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago settled in the dunes. They captured the store in their paintings. And Edwin Waite Teal, who wrote Dune Boy, captured the family members and the store in his autobiographical Dune Boy, The Early Years of a Naturalist. So anyway, there were some stories worth preserving, so I wove those into a fiction. And one was to give Lurie House a reputation. The family had been out of the dunes for so long that they were totally forgotten, except for their headstones in the cemetery. And having being involved in the Jewish community, there really weren't any fictions that portrayed the Jewish community from an insider's perspective. I've given some talks on novels in the area where Jewish characters or references are told, and for the most part they're sympathetic, but there was nothing contemporary, and I wanted to write something that wasn't a Holocaust story or an immigrant story, but something that was truly Midwestern American Jewish story, and I think I've done that with Toys in the Closet.
It's a very evocative read. Your language is very beautiful, and I really felt that I was experiencing everything. You know, you take us on a really great journey in
Thank you.
Yeah, I agree with you, Esther. You're trying to visualize these places, and of course, the fun part of it is living here in the Duneland area. You just feel like you really are almost connected to this story, and which I would encourage our listeners if you get a chance. It's a wonderful read. And like I said, I only hit the first three chapters because of time prepping and everything. But I could not put it down. That's what I was doing. I was reading it online. So.
Well, I try to put in lots of vignettes about Indiana. You know, in 20 years' time, we all become forgotten once we're gone. And just going through your agenda today of how many art shows are going on at the present time, it's amazing. You know, this is a very rich area of culture. And I think Pete Visklosky does a wonderful job selling Northwest Indiana and what a wonderful experience is to come out of this area. Unfortunately, our kids go away to college and they don't come back, and we're part of the Hoosier brain drain. But the richness and the people that have made significant contributions to the world and to the nation that come out of these neighborhoods is spectacular. And I've tried to include some of those people from the past in Toys in the Closet.
I agree. I think Northwest Indiana is beginning to see a collective identity. I was in the 90s part of Leadership Northwest Indiana, which goal was now to make connections from all different areas and cross-pollinate both and everything. You have the Northwest Indiana Forum, and I always told people, as if you took Northwest Indiana, especially like the three counties or so, and transplant in the middle of somewhere, it'd be about the size of Indianapolis and everything. So we tend to look to Chicago, and we live in that shadow of Chicago, but we really have creativity right here.
Oh, and charming, charming small towns.
Yes.
You feel like you're in the past sometimes. It's just really sweet. Now we just need to get the businesses back in there to give us that experience again.
Well, we're in a transition period.
It's a beautiful transition
period. You know, we've gone from farming to industrial, and we thought we were moving into a service economy. And I think that's the challenging part now is who are we now,
right,
and how do we maximize what we have.
And what do we need to fulfill our daily needs that can be handled in going to a small town business?
Well, the population is certainly here, and the brain power is here, and it's just maximizing. But it's the diversity is what gives us our richness.
Oh, exactly.
Also.
Very much so.
Well, I have to question, your central character is Nathan, and I wonder how much of Nathan and Trent are living together.
Well, Nathan was a creation of Trent, but Nathan is not Trent. Trent wishes he had Nathan's money and
right,
some of his projects, but there's a one's fiction and one is not. But I did use some of life experiences. Even though this was a Hoosier Pride story from a progressive perspective, I did try to portray some of the problems that we endure in a diverse community.
Sure.
And there certainly was anti-Semitism in Crown Point, and I portrayed that. I'd had a school teacher during the Yom Kippur War scream out to the audience that he wanted to round up the Jews and the Cubans and nuke them. And that was a epiphany moment for me, and I was very unhappy with that. And I was also very unhappy when they nominated that person a few years ago for the alumni honorary award from the High School Hall of Fame or something. I had warned them what this person had said, and it was uncanny. At my 40th high school reunion, someone came up to me and said, "Do you remember?" And I said, "You remember that too?"
Yeah.
But so I get into stuff like that, and my mother being in the real estate company, in the business, you know, I've seen racism firsthand. We've gotten threatening phone calls for selling houses to Latinos. you know, it's just, it's ridiculous.
It almost sounds unbelievable, you know?
You know, 50 years from now, we'll look back at it as so trite, and it's sad. But I think we're overcoming this slowly, little by little.
I think we've unfortunately backpedaled a little bit recently in the last few years, and in many ways, and that's unfortunate because I thought we kind of got over that hump and everything. So.
It's a spooky period, but as one leader said, that it's probably a good civics lesson.
That's true.
Because it's a wake-up call that if you don't pay attention and you don't get involved, bad things can happen.
And there is so much more involvement now.
Yes. Yeah, I found it interesting that Nathan was also a jeweler in Scottsdale, Arizona.
For Goldwaters, yes.
Senior Goldwaters.
Yes, Goldwaters. Well, that was kind of the, Goldwaters was kind of, I mean, there were a number of department stores in Arizona, but Goldwater and Arizona are kind of synonymous terms.
Right.
And I had no relationship with Goldwaters, but I thought it was great for the story since there was an Arizona setting. And there's a lot of jewelry in this. So there's a secret. There's a vault in Nathan's beach house that is filled with the mother's jewels. And so jewelers tend to like the story because there's lots of jewelry in
it. Wow. I haven't gotten there yet, so I'm still listening to the descriptive parts of the house, the Lurie house and Brighton house and everything, and Dan and
Max, the caretaker.
Max. And the funny part, it took me a while to figure out who Ephrat was.
Ephrat.
Ephrat?
Ephrat.
Yeah, I thought, okay, no, sorry. And then all of a sudden, I think is when you first entered the house, oh, it's a dog.
Ephrat is the greyhound.
And I should have figured that out from the cover of the book, you know, but I'm trying to, is it a person or what is it? You know, because there wasn't a lot said until then.
Yeah, when I lived temporarily in West Texas. And my roommate wanted a dog, and we ended up with a greyhound, which turned out to be one of the best pets I ever had. And I wanted to name her Ephrat because I had a friend in Israel that had just died. She was the daughter of a famous muralist and had taken her life. And I had gone to Israel in February of '88, hoping to meet her, and then called her house and found out that she'd been gone for a year. So I came back and I said, let's name the dog Ephrat. And my roommate said, no, the name is too Jewish. Although his name was very Jewish also. So that's the irony there. So I thought, well, in the story, the greyhound is going to be a fraud.
Oh, there you go. You can yes. Create your own reality.
Yes, yes.
I think it's a good point to maybe have, if you wouldn't mind reading a selected excerpt from the book.
Sure. I'll read the opening pages. It's a Dune story. I should set the story up.
Okay.
Nathan Franklin is the heroine of the story, the protagonist. He is an author. He's won an Oscar for best screenplay adaptation of one of his novels that was turned into a motion picture. He lives mostly in Paradise Valley, but he had bought an old house in the dunes, which just happens to be the 1863 Lurie house. And he uses that originally as his summer camp. And he buys the house from Dan and Max, who later become his caretakers. And staying in the dunes, that Lurie house becomes his lucky talisman. So he wins his Oscar. He's got the old family homestead. And his maternal grandmother, who had been involved with saving the dunes all of her life, and who owned several hundred acres in the dunes, leaves him her dunes acres when she passes. And it was her request that Nathan build a house on her property because she doesn't trust the government. Even though she was involved with saving the dunes, she's suspicious of the government. And so she says, hold on to it for another generation before you turn it over to the Park Service. So he builds this massive house. His father's the chief CFO for Lurie Enterprises in Chicago, and that's Lurie. My mother's an Lewry Lurie, and dad's related to the others. And so Nathan builds this massive trophy house on the beach, and our story opens with him coming back out of season on Christmas Day in the aftermath of a blizzard on Christmas Day 1997. And there's been a blizzard, and no airport cabbie will take him to Northwest Indiana. So he takes the South Shore train to the Beverly Shores train station, and our story opens with this Dr. Zhivago-esque scenery at the Beverly Shores Depot, except instead of a horse and buggy or horse and sleigh, there's two purple snowmobiles.
This is Trent Bentley's Toys in the Closet.
Chapter 1, The Homecoming to Brighton House. There was only one more snow-covered dune to ascend before Brighton House would come into view for the three men and a dog in two purple snowmobiles approaching the frozen lakeshore. Nathan, riding in an open sleigh, pulled along by one of the fast-moving snow racers, covered his face again with a lengthy scarf, which had blown loose several times from around his collar. The rush of the freezing air was bitter, and Nathan watched anxiously for his beach house to appear on the winter horizon. On Nathan's lap sat Afrat, his Brendelmark greyhound, who was cloaked in a colorful wool blanket and protected by the arms of his heavy cashmere coat. Sailing next to them as they were about to leave an old dune forest of snow-flocked and ice-over trees was a matching racer and tandem sleigh, and together the snowmobile's purring engines were breaking the morning's otherwise serene silence. That's the opening paragraph of Toys in the Closet.
And that makes you just want to go right on.
Go and get that book.
Yeah, go and get the book.
Where can they find the book?
It's on Amazon. I do have copies in the lobby at Fish Camp. And I'm anxious to get back there today because Nicole has made this Tuscany bean soup, which is fabulous.
It is soup weather today.
Yes, it is that kind of soup weather. Yeah, it's Amazon. I think it's only like $9.99 if you want to download it. It's a Kindle.
Oh, that's the Kindle. Yeah,
the Kindle.
The paperback copies are $19.99.
Yeah, but I think it's a well worth read and everything like that. So anyway, you're talking about a follow up to the. First of all, how many pages in it? I looked at this.
It's 794 pages, and it was published. It became my lifetime achievement award, and I never thought the struggle for saving the story that I have the grandmother that's a Save the Dunes advocate, and had been involved with saving the dunes from the beginning, and in the paternal grandfather in the story is an Inland Steel Board of director. So you have that dichotomy in the same family of an industrialist and an environmentalist, which is very typical in our area to have people in opposing viewpoints for whatever the cause is. Brighton House is also full of artwork, so there's about 115 mostly local artists mentioned in the story. There's also some important pieces in Nathan's collection. Afternoon at the Indiana Dunes, which is an understudy by Leroy Neiman, is in the story. I met Leroy Neiman at a Super Bowl party in Scottsdale, and I asked him about his mural that was in the Mercantile Bank in Hammond for a number of years. The Art Institute has just acquired it, and it's in the lobby of 37 South Wabash in the Loop now. And it's a 60-foot length mural by 8 feet high. It's a summer setting of the dunes, of beach, of hundreds of kids and people and umbrellas and beach balls and the Chicago skyline in the back and the industrial plants on the other side of the beach. And he had painted the Hancock Building into the skyline before the Hancock Building was erected. So when he unveiled the painting in 65, 66, the skyline had this George Jetson futuristic look to it. So when I asked Leroy about this painting, he said, "Do you know that work? That's very important to me." And so I wrote to him and asked why the painting was important. And it was important because his wife had helped him paint it. And she's in the painting. She's one of the beach bathers, and so is his mother-in-law. She's the frumpy-looking lady in the Chase Lounge at center court in the painting. But he told me this great vignette that I included in the story, that when he unveiled the painting at the Mercantile Bank in Hammond, there were black kids in the paintings, and one patron said she wanted them taken out. Oh. And so Nathan sees that in Toys in the Closet. He was there as a child and sees how his father responds to that lady. And Neiman, by the way, circumvented the whole discussion by saying they're not black kids, they're just kids with a dark tan, and moved on from it. So But there's that's how I try to tell our history and things that happened through vignettes like that. So,
how much did you have to edit out of the book?
The editing process from signing the contract with the publishers through publication was a 7-month process, and we didn't take much out.
That's good.
But the editing was very laborious, and luckily I was between jobs at the time, and so I had some free time, and I wanted to get it done, and I worked on it day and night, and it was a 7-month project. And then when it came out, I thought I would be ringing a bell or something in celebration. But when the box arrived and I realized that it was like a birth of a child, right. It's like, now I have to market this thing and now I have to raise it. So it wasn't, there wasn't the celebration like I thought I would.
It was a long gestation, what, like 7+ years?
Well, the other irony was that I had said my book was a poetic sequel to Dune Boy. And Mom had found this house in the dunes, and I bought it because there was the connection with her family. But then after I was in the house for a month, found out that her family hadn't built the house, that Edwin Waitiel had built the house.
Like, wow.
And I had, before I made that connection, I said, no wonder he became a naturalist. There's bugs all over the place, bugs I've never seen before. And I had picked wallpaper out for around the fireplace that had dragonflies, because one of his chapters in Dune Boy is about the dragonette, his glider that he had made. So there was a connection there. It was kind of like a meant-to-be thing. And so I do think that Toys in the Closet is sort of a 20th century, late 20th century sequel to Dune Boy.
Oh, very good. Now the sequel, let's look forward just a little bit.
Well, Nathan has called home to Brighton House. He's not sure why he's been called home. He just has this innate feeling he's got to get back. But he's having that feeling on Thanksgiving. His parents have already passed on. Most of the family elders are gone. He has an estranged brother that he's sometimes in touch with. And so he can't get away from Scottsdale because he's hosting this Jewish dance on Christmas Eve. And so he stays in Scottsdale through Christmas Eve and then takes the red eye home to Chicago. And that's when he encounters the blizzard and has to take the South Shore. And Toys in the Closet is a one-day story. It's his touring the house and going from room to room, as any of us would do when we're away from a dwelling for a while. And he's having flashbacks as he goes from room to room. And sometimes the flashbacks are stimulated by a painting. There's about 115 artists mentioned in the story. And at the end of the story, you know why he's been called home. The struggle of saving our beaches as a national park was one of the most vicious confrontations between industrialist and environmentalist. That's Roland Engel's term that comes out of Sacred Sands. And the struggle hasn't ended. I mean, we see that with people trying to build hotels or restaurants on state park ground, which the national park and the state park that we have is a very compromised park of what the original visionaries foresaw. They originally foresaw everything from Miller Beach to Trail Creek, where Fish Camp is at, as 25 miles of national park. But World War I derailed it, and then the subdivisions were established when Dunes Highway came through, and it just became a nasty fight. The sequel is Nathan and his brothers are using the inheritance that they have received from their parents to redevelop the west side of Michigan City as a tax shelter and also as a benefit for the Shirley Hines Land Trust. In Toys in the Closet, I knew about Save the Dunes Council, but I didn't know about Shirley Hines Land Trust when I was writing Toys. I did slip it into the storyline before it went to press. But the next story is going to be about the brothers doing all they can to help buy land for Shirley Hines Land Trust. And in the process, they've bought up the whole west side of Michigan City, which ironically is on the cusp of becoming very important real estate, with the Nipsco plant going away, the South Shore tracks, doubling. And so that West Side neighborhood, which is essentially an urban slum and has been since Pullman pulled out and the power plant was built in 1970, has been just kind of an oversight neighborhood. But the houses there have good bones. You're close to the beach. You've got Mount Baldy right there. And you've got the lighthouse place right there. And you've got new lakefront that's going to open up in 10 years. So if Trent was Nathan, he'd be doing what I'm writing about.
Well, you coming across that whole NIPSCO departing that, and I guess there's what in Michigan City a council or a group that's coming together to plan, what
Michigan
to do.
City is really expanding and being really thoughtful and.
Well, where the power plant is now, where Ensel built the original 1930s plant, that was the site of the Hoosier Slide, which was a 200-foot dune that was like a 7-story building or 20-story building. And it was the tallest of all the dunes, and it was such a tourist attraction that the steamships used to come across the lake from Chicago to look at it. When President McKinley's train arrived in Michigan City in 1897, I think, the 21-gun salute was shot off from the top of the Hoosier Slide. But the sand was so fine that the Ball Company and others sand mined the sand to make their blue glass jars. But that Hoosier Slide was in the vision of the original National Park and was one of the first major losses.
Huge.
So hopefully they're very smart with how they use that, because that was in the vision of the National Park, that land.
Well, I'm sure you're much in favor of it, though right now it seems to be stalled from making it into a true national park and not just the lakeshore, because that's much more irreversible once it gets park status.
I've just finished reading Duel for the Dunes, which was written by two ladies from Beverly Shores, which really tells quite eloquently how the whole Midwest and Bethlehem Steel came about, which was 5 miles of the lakeshore. That was the most beautiful part of the lakeshore that was sand mined away to fill in the lake in Evanston for Northwestern's campus. And once they sand mined that land and destroyed those high dunes, there was Mother Nature's beauty was gone. And Duel for the Dunes tells the story very eloquently of how, Indiana really didn't, after Sam Taggart, who was our first senator who had lobbied for the national park, he was a one-term senator, and once he was out of office, the whole park thing evaporated here in the dunes. And then Valparaiso did not want a national park. They did not want a state park. And the politics that are portrayed in this book are just absolutely enchanting. And all the different factions that helped and didn't help tell that story. So I try to get into a little bit more of that in my sequel, because the story of saving the beaches is not over. And there will always be opportunists that are trying to build where they shouldn't be or poisoning the land where they shouldn't be. And that's where Save the Dunes Council has become more of an advocate of monitoring our own government to make sure that they do their jobs and that the mills aren't dumping more cyanide or pollutants into the lake and water than they should be.
Especially with a right now currently weakened EPA, from a federal level. I guess the states and local governments really have to be much more of a watchdog.
Step up, yeah.
Well, Duel for the Dunes tells the story of how the country kind of grew up and became more environmentally oriented. Indiana, the state of Indiana, never gave really a flying shish kebab about saving the park.
Right.
In fact, I found an article at the Chicago Historical Society that sometime in the 1950s, the Indiana General Assembly had passed a bill recommending to the U.S. Congress that if Illinois wanted a national park so much, they recommended the loop be destroyed and Indiana would donate the sand and the beer cans to cover it. And that pretty much represents how Indiana thought of the whole park program.
Well, and also, you know, Northwest Indiana was one of the latter part of the states to develop because, you know, south of us, you know, because of the marshland, you know, people didn't develop north here. And so it was sort of late to develop and I think late to find its identity, you know, to stand up for things like that. You know, they looked at a big dune like that, the Hoosier Slides, oh, look, what a great resource that is. Let's mine that.
Exactly.
And that's a shame. I mean, Highlands suffer the same thing along Ridge Road there. And I know we talked about it before the show. You can see where the ridge is still, and then all of a sudden it stops and goes flat. And I remember as a kid, they were still sand mining that and sand mining that a little bit in Black Oak area still.
And the EPA, what the generation today, you know, 20 years, everything. In the story I write about the gay pride poster that was very controversial in the Chesterton High School back in the early 90s, and I was talking to a friend that recently graduated from Chesterton High School and knew nothing about that. And it was a national spotlight story at that time. And where was I going with this? I forget now.
I talked about how Highland and the area sand mine things and just without regard to...
I was thinking of something of the beaches and
So how far are you into the sequel?
I'm not going to make the sequel as big a book as Toys in the Closet because the size of the book intimidates people. It's the 794 pages makes a thick book. So I'm 200 pages into it. I think the majority of the work is done. But I keep finding things. You know, I was trying to find two subdivisions that were underneath Bethlehem and Midwest Steel that didn't have the Caucasian Gentile restrictions, as did so many of the other subdivisions. And looking at the old plat maps, I found this name Shala Romberg that owned 99 acres. And I thought, well, that's kind of suspicious. That sounds kind of Jewish. And so I chased that name down. And she was an author that published a series of short stories through Rand McNally in 1916. And her father was a famous Chicago banker that owned some of those parcels before her. And he was the banker that restabilized the U.S. currency after the Civil War. So just chasing one name down off of a plat map turned into a mountain of information.
You know, that's the beautiful thing about what you do. And being a historian is just, boy, it never ends.
What's the name of the sequel?
The sequel will be called Lurie Lurie.
Okay.
And because I'm related to
two different
families, that they're pronounced the same way, and yet there's sort of a dichotomy there also. So I'm having fun with that.
So who's in your personal art collection?
Holly Jackson. I probably have a couple hundred paintings. I just saw an estate sale that's taking place in Munster that has a Charlotte Brower, the silk screen. I have Barbara Meeker.
Oh, yeah. I know Barbara Meeker.
Yeah, I have one of hers. I have, you caught me off guard.
Well, the other question I had is how close is your residence and Brighton, Nathan's Brighton? Are they...
Lurie House is just down the highway from me in Furnaceville.
Okay.
And then Brighton House is directly north of that, like a straight line north. Brighton House is where Kimmel Beach is at.
Okay.
If you imagine where the blowout is at for the parking lot,
right?
That's where I envisioned Brighton House.
I was trying to map that out, you know, and I thought, well, that's, and I guess I came pretty close to where it would
There's
be.
A lady in Beverly Shores that wants me to give a tour of where to show her where all the things are at in the story and Toys
That'd
in
be
the
interesting.
Closet.
That,
I'll sign up for that tour.
Yeah, I'll bring my camera along.
So here, I was corrected with Furnaceville to say Furnaceville. Which is it?
I think it depends on who you ask.
Oh, okay. So you can get corrected both ways.
Yeah, our family has always said Furnaceville, where some of the family members of that family pronounce it the other way. But no one in our family had ever pronounced it with the accent. So,
very good. Well, any final thoughts you have? We have about less than 2 minutes here, Trent.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I hope that there's reviews on Amazon. I didn't tell much of the story. I talked a lot about it, but there's reviews, and I do have the book at Fish Camp. So come see me today. We have delicious foods waiting for you, and
we
have live music on Wednesday, Thursday, and Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock.
Different people, or
Johnny V's on Sunday evening. Angela Chico is there on Thursday evenings, and then we have rotating vocalist on Wednesday.
Well, you've been listening to our guest, Trent Pendley. We really thank him, author of Toys in the Closet. And you've been listening to Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Friday at 11 a.m., rebroadcast at Monday at 5 p.m. Your hosts, Larry Breckner and Esther Golden. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP station manager.
Thanks, Greg.
If you're interested in being a guest, again, Art on the Air, WVLP@gmail.com. Next week, we have Wendy Marciniak, executive director from the Chesterton Arts Center, as our guest. See you next week right here at 103.1. Art on the Air.
Aloha. Jack.